Hi there, my name's Jeremy Thomas, and I am the host of Shed Talks. Shed Talks hopes to be an entertaining, informative podcast that looks at well-being and mental health. And I hope you're going to like it. I'm going to be in conversation with well-known, interesting figures. Now, when it gets to the end of that conversation, don't rush off, because we have got the illustrious, wondrous psychologist Karen Cowan on hand to discuss what's been said and to give us some insight and various tips on what we can do with our mental health. It's all going to be great. Enjoy. So, welcome to episode 7 of Shed Talks. Our guest this episode is Gordon Darroch. Gordon is a highly successful international journalist and is the very first non-UK resident to appear on Shed Talks Live. He's in The Hague in Holland. And despite that, he's told me that he's a dedicated Norwich City supporter and a dedicated Scotland supporter. He's fluent in English, Dutch and German, virtually mastered Italian, French and Romanian. Yikes! He's a wordsmith, a cellist, and evidently not a bad cook either. He's the father of two boys, Ewan and Adam, both of whom were diagnosed with autism at quite a young age. Above all, he's the author of an outstanding memoir called All the Time We Thought We Had, which is based upon the life he shared with his late wife, Machteld, who sadly died of breast cancer. Would you please welcome, and we're going to welcome, Gordon Darroch. Gordon, hi.
Hello, Jeremy, and thank you for that very generous introduction.
Well, well deserved. So, I read your book, All the Time We Thought We Had, and I thought it was an exceptional memoir. This book is so articulate in terms of the emotion, in terms of telling it how it really is. It's just an extraordinary story. And I just wanted to say that I loved the way you ended the book with the letter to Machteld. And I thought it was such a wonderful thing, really beautifully written. And I am, you know, another life that I have. I give a lot of talks on mental health to companies and to schools and all sorts of people. And I always bang on to them and say, writing is great therapy. And I'm just going to assume that you would sort of vaguely agree with that.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it was a very therapeutic exercise. I think just sorting out all the different thoughts and the different emotions that were in my head during the grieving process. Also, there was an element of, I think it maybe magnified the sense of grief a bit and maybe even extended the grieving process, which...
Deferred it
a little bit, yeah. I think there was a stage, I think, where I was really struggling with the emotional side, and the solution was just to get down all the hard facts on paper and from that then extrapolate the feelings. And actually, when I was writing the book, I had to consult Facebook, because things happened in such a blur at the time, in real time, that I actually forgotten what order things happened in. And, and sometimes time got stretched or compressed at particularly difficult times. Like, I mean, the fact that Machteld went from being able to walk 2 miles to the doctor's surgery to being in a wheelchair in the space of a week. I mean, that just seemed incomprehensible when I read it back.
Yes.
I think, a process of actually visualizing, getting it on paper, what had happened and how I felt about it. And that was a very therapeutic exercise, definitely. And also expanding it then into kind of wider thoughts, I guess, about mortality and dealing with autism and the whole process of how Machteld experienced her cancer as well, which was quite a thing to be confronted with.
I think that is what is so interesting about the book, that it's not just about Gordon, as it were. You know, that it isn't sort of going, well, and then you won't believe it. You actually get her POV a lot, which I think that was great. But I wanted to say that I love also the way you describe how you first met. You were 18. She was what, 15, 16?
No, she was 17. Yeah,
she was 17.
She just turned 17, I think. Yeah, and I was 18, getting on for 19. Yeah, so I was an old hand.
and you met in an Italian campsite.
Yes, yes, we did. We met in a campsite that was on a hillside overlooking Lake Garda, which I think I said is a place where it's very hard not to fall in love, because it's, I'd roll up the side of my tent, because I worked as a campsite courier. I'd roll up the tent every morning and was, you know, treated to this view of the lake and had my breakfast overlooking it. So yeah, it was a very romantic location. And she came on holiday for a week. She just finished her exams. Yeah. And came on holiday with a school friend in a caravan and stayed for a week. And I think it wasn't until about the third or fourth day that she was there that one of my colleagues, he was Dutch and he was about 25, I think. So he seemed like a, you know, elder statesman to me at that time. he said to me, I think that blonde girl who's wandering around, I think she quite likes you. You should go and talk to her. So, yeah. And then he kind of fixed us up for not even a date, just a sort of, you know, just a chat to say hello. I think yes. Cecil came over, and that was how it all started.
God. and it went quite well. It went, didn't it, over a period of months it got going.
It did, but it was all very, I mean, I suspected that it was very innocent to begin with. I mean, it was kind of some fumbled kisses outside my tent after we'd been for one glass of wine at the campsite bar. And then she drove away after three very enjoyable days, and I expected I'd never see her again. I thought, you know, it's just one of those holiday romances, and that was nice. But, you know, how on earth could I expect to you know, keep a relationship going with somebody who lived in a country I'd never been to? Then the night she got back, she phoned the campsite. So all the staff were kind of egging me on, saying, oh, you know, she's on the phone. And then she phoned again, I think, the next day, and sort of every couple of weeks thereafter. But bear in mind, this is 1993, when international phone calls cost an absolute fortune. So she had to kind of sneak into the hallway when her father wasn't around, because he was the one who paid the phone bill. conduct this clandestine relationship.
But, you know, it's incredible. It's got such, I don't want to sound pretentious, but it's got such richness, this experience of you two doing this. You know, especially compared to now, where everybody's going, I've got my mobile, everyone's got, you know, phones, and they're going Tinder, Minder, Cinder, Linda, you know. And this was actually tent to tent and then ringing a campsite. And so anyway, brilliant. Yeah. And then basically you went to Edinburgh University and then she basically came over.
Yeah, that was, let me think now. Yeah, I went up to, it was in my gap year that we met. So I went up to Edinburgh University, and then at the end of my third year, after we'd been carrying on with this long distance relationship, and mostly actually it was writing letters rather than phone calls. I think we're probably about the last people in the world who still wrote regular love letters to each other. And after 3 years of that, she came over, found a job in a flower shop. She trained as a florist.
Yes.
And obviously, as a Dutch trained florist, it was never any problem for her to find work. And that was how we started. So yeah, like, we spent my final year in university living as a couple in the centre of Edinburgh. And then after that, when I graduated, she stayed in Edinburgh. Actually, she went and moved into a student flat, because I went to do my postgrad in Preston, the University of Central Lancashire. And after that, we moved together to Peterborough, Northampton, and finally Glasgow.
And when did you had the boys? Was that before you got married? After I can't remember.
No, it was after we got married. Getting married is one of those things that we thought when you were younger we weren't going to bother, and just sort of didn't really see it as a priority thing, and then decided, I think, just after we moved to Glasgow that we would. But we got married in 2001, and then the boys were born. Ewan was born in 2003, and Adam came along 2 years later, 2005.
And you stayed in Glasgow, as it were?
Yeah, and we were in Glasgow that whole time. We were in Glasgow for 13 years altogether. A good long stretch in Scotland.
And presumably, you know, like most people, you are just, you know, going along thinking this is great, you know, or that's a nightmare. This isn't a nightmare. I'm really enjoying my life. We're great. We're happy. And it's all going to be very, very groovy. And the last thing you were expecting was a problem. I mean, how old was Maktal when the symptoms occurred of the breast cancer?
She was diagnosed when she was 36, and she'd noticed the lump in her breast in around about May, I think. And so she went for the diagnosis. We went on holiday to France with her family, which was quite awkward because she was just waiting for the results of these tests to come back. And then she got the diagnosis actually on my birthday, when I turned 38 and she was 36 and a half. So,
gosh. And I mean, you describe all of this, you know, in the book really well. And what the sense I have of Maktal was that, a really lovely person who clearly, though, was Dutch in the sense that my experience of Dutch people, of which is reasonable, is that they actually don't mess about.
Mm.
You know, they call it how it is, say it how it is.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And I definitely felt that with your wife. I thought that was exactly what she was like. And I mean, there was a lovely, there's a thing where, you know, she said, when it got more advanced, she said, you know, this should not be happening to me. I am not an old lady.
Yeah, she was a very matter of fact kind of person, but not totally unsentimental either. But yeah, she was very good at voicing that kind of anger, and it wasn't self pity in any way. It was just literally, why don't I get to have these decades in my life that I was expecting to have? You know, it was just she had to process that sort of sense of disbelief, I think. She did very well, or as well as you can do, given that it's something that's absolutely thrown at you. And it's absolutely final as well. You know, it's not something you can, say one of the stages of grief is bargaining, but, the ultimate outcome of that is you realise that you can't bargain.
Yes.
And she got through that, I think, pretty quickly. And she's one of her friends that she met, who was also a cancer patient, so she met her actually at the Maggie Centre, which is a place I always like to plug because they're wonderful places, Maggie Centres, and she met her there. And she said to me when I went to see her after Maktal died, she said, I was amazed how quickly she just accepted it. And yeah, that was my feeling as well, that Maktal within 1 or 2 weeks, because she got the final terminal diagnosis, literally as we were preparing to move to Holland. And the first couple of days, she was absolutely, distraught and enraged by the fact that, her life was going to end quickly. And then it was, I said to her, are we going to go ahead with this? We had the move planned. We had we just literally sold the house the week before in Scotland. I said, we're still going to do this. And she said, yes, absolutely. She still never lost sight of the fact that, she had this, even though she now knew that it was going to be, she wasn't going to be with us for more than probably, a few months, certainly less than a year, that she still wants to go ahead and get the practical side done and get the move across to Holland sorted out and get the boys into Dutch schools and all the difficulties that involved. And she was just very, very hard-headed and pragmatic about the whole thing. It was quite remarkable, actually.
Do you think that was a sort of contract with herself, sometimes we can do that, can't we? We can sort of trick ourselves into, it's like, I said I'd go to Skegness and I am bloody well going. Maybe more than that, because there was so much... That was where she came from, but it's a big deal to do that. I can see it though. It's almost animalistic. I've got to make it to the other side, then I don't mind.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think there's a certain image. I use a phrase in the book. My feeling was that once that your life is going to end very soon, you live in a kind of exalted present. The future is gone. It's vanished. Yeah. It doesn't exist. You don't have a future. You have a short spell of time. You don't know how long it's going to be. but you have these, you basically live in the present and you look ahead, and also that you don't worry about your own future anymore. You know what that's going to be, and that's a pretty awful prospect. But you actually worry about the future of the people you left behind. So I think she was totally geared towards setting us up. I mean, she flew over to spend a weekend with a couple of days with her sister in the February after being diagnosed in the January to go house hunting. So the house we live in now is the house that she found on that trip to go and stay with her sister. And she just wanted to get everything sorted out. You know, she lived, she existed entirely for, you know, for our future and for our boy's future, I think.
And also to achieve something. I mean, I've had a few people in my life die of cancer. And I think one of the awful things is how overwhelming it is. And, you know, how you become rather powerless. And so I think for her, it must have been, no, I'm going to do those things. Almost to put two fingers up to the disease.
I think that was a big element of that, definitely. It was a way of, to use an unfortunate phrase, a way of taking back control.
Yes.
But she wanted to still live on her own terms. She didn't want to just be a cancer patient. And I think that's the thing I think is almost a universal experience, I think, of all the, because obviously now that since she died, I've joined a community of widows, and we talk a lot about our partners in their last days. And it's almost a universal thing that they're absolutely driven to do something, you know, not just to be defined by the disease and the fact that they're not just to sit around waiting for death. You know, that old cliche that people are very brave for fighting on. You don't really have an alternative. You can't just sit in a chair and wait to die. It's actually physically impossible. You have to have something to do, even yes. if you know that your horizon may only be a couple of months.
Yeah. Well, I that's another thing. That's what I thought was some interesting things you said in the book, which was that you talk about perhaps some of the more unpleasant aspects of dealing with cancer. And I don't know exactly where it happens, but you talked about the fact that it became quite difficult at one stage between the two of you, you know, and you went, oh my God, I mean, I'm not liking this at all.
Mm. No, absolutely not. I think it was, and there was a tension between us because she resented the fact that, you know, obviously she was going to die. And sometimes she projected that onto me, as I think you do in a relationship. All your worst fears and all your worst things, you tend to, you know, your partner is your outlet. Yes. And I, of course, had these awful fears for what life was going to be like. I was trying not to think of what was going to happen next, you know, because I was going to be when I was a surviving partner as a single parent and all the rest of it. And you try and push those ideas, those thoughts back in your head, but they bubble back up to the surface and you think, this isn't right. I shouldn't be thinking about this. I should be thinking about looking after her. But it's unavoidable that you do still have a future. And I think that disconnection, I think that's something that I remember Michel Farber, who's one of my very favorite writers, describing when he came to give a talk in The Hague. And he said that he also lost his wife to cancer. She was in her early 50s. And he felt like, you know, once someone's had that terminal diagnosis, they've had that confirmation that they exist almost on a different planet from you. You know, you live almost in parallel worlds, and that can make it very hard to communicate. So, yeah, there were definitely yes. times of very high tension between us. And there was even a time, actually, when we were a couple of months before she died, that I said to Machtelt, you know, and it'll sound really selfish, but I said to Michael, I kind of need a holiday here. You know, I just need to go away for a couple of days and, you know, not have the stress of coping for you. And this is a time when she was still fairly mobile. So she said, well, just go away. You know, she said, so I went off to the Highlands for a couple of nights and she looked after the boys by herself, which, you know, given that I think it's about 3 months before she died, was amazing, an amazing sacrifice by her, actually. But I think she did it for me, but also for her own well-being, because, you know, the tension was quite high in the house.
To see that she could do it.
I think partly she wants to see that she could do it. She could still do it. I mean, she was still able to cope. But I think about a week after I got back, she had a flare-up of the tumours in her spine, had to go into hospital. So I think it was lucky that we got away with it. But, she wanted to show that she still had her independence, but I think she also, we both wanted that just relief of having our own space again. Because, being cooped up in the house with a cancer patient and all the anxiety and all the, you know, the fact that you have to care for them through day and night is exhausting. It's absolutely exhausting. So
one of the things I also liked that you said, and whether it came out of MacTel, I don't know, was that everybody makes this slight mistake where we go, oh, you know, Teddy, he was so brave. And, you know, he really fought hard and absolutely, you know, he fought to the end. And, you know, I'd never heard him complain once.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you talk about that and debunk that, which is like, yeah, how great for Teddy.
Yeah. And he pretty certainly did complain, but you weren't there to hear it. But yeah, I think certainly Muck complained very loudly at times. And also, I mean, sometimes he was just in, you know, excruciating pain. I think people who are advanced stages of cancer sort of hide the pain because they don't want to frighten you with it. Because it is just, I mean, there were times when she just woke up in the night, and there's one time and just screaming from the pains that were shooting up and down her spine. And I remember going down to breakfast one morning and Adam saying, you know, I heard you screaming in the night, Mum. And that's an awful thing to be confronted with. And she, I think, tried to hide it from us. And I think that's an almost a very universal thing as well. The raw pain and mortality is an unbearable thing.
But likewise, that one wants to hide something from somebody, but that, you know, it is that idea that somebody suffering in that way needs to have a way of expressing it. You know, whether it's, you know, beating the mattress to death with a stick, or because otherwise you're just, again, you're this victim and who's really in terrible pain, you know.
Yes.
You know, and in the end you got to Holland. Yeah, you. I know you're fond of talking about Dutch bureaucracy.
Yes.
And that MacTel's, you know, really whizzed around, saw people, filled in forms. I mean, it's amazing.
One of my abiding memories of her is that I would go into her room in the hospice, because when we first moved to Holland, she moved straight into a hospice, literally from got off the plane. And she would sit there at a desk in her room with a big pile of paperwork and just on the phone to, you know, like to school authorities or to local council, and just trying to bat through all this stuff, trying to sort of fill in forms and sorting out home help as well. Another thing that she did while she was in a few weeks that she was still with us in Holland, because you know, for context, so we moved at the start of April and she died at the end of May, and in that time she managed to find a person to work as a kind of nanny for the boys to look after them, so that I could have a bit of a life and, more importantly, go out and spend some time working and earning money for the family. So that was an exceptional thing. And to be doing all that when, you know, you're in pain, you're living in a hospice, you don't know how many even weeks that you got left on this earth, is an extraordinary thing, actually, when I think about it.
I wondered if I could read this a tiny bit, and it's certainly not the best bit, but it sort of, I liked it, and it's after she's died, and it's when you were arranging the funeral. Funerals in the Netherlands are arranged briskly in a matter of days. Within a few hours of MacTel's life ending, and with the sun that had risen as we sat together at the dining table still dangling in the sky, I opened the door to an immaculately dressed young man with an expression of studied compassion, soft wide eyes, a polite conciliatory smile, and the air of being ready to listen for all eternity. Senek and I guided him into the living room and gestured to him to sit down. "Was the lady ill?" he asked. "It was expected and unexpected," I said. "She had terminal cancer, but until the last few days she seemed to be coping well." I tried to suppress a sob, then yielded to it. For half a minute, it was the only sound in the room, which seemed suddenly to have swelled to the size of a cathedral. Then I took a deep breath and we carried on. And, you know, I think to myself that, you know, if you were on your own, it might have been a slightly different story, but you had the boys.
Yes, I think very much. I think certainly in the beginning, because the boys were there, it's something I had to deal with every day, a reason to get up in the morning because I had to put their breakfast on the table and make sure they got out to school in the morning. So yes, I think that gave me, that was a very important distraction apart from anything else. I know other people who are widowed at this kind of age who don't have children. They find that very, very difficult, the fact that the entire structure of your life just falls away.
No routine.
There's no routine. There's nothing to get up for in the morning. There's no reason to leave the house, and you don't really feel like spending time with your friends, and most people just get on with their lives. I mean, that's a great thing that you discover when you're bereaved, is that, you know, even people who are maybe good friends or relatives of your partner, they're with you and they're in touch with you and they support you for the first couple of weeks, but people very quickly fade away because what's happened to you is of a different order. You know, it's kind of like I always compare it to you live in a street of houses, and one day a bomb's dropped on one of them or a plane falls out of the sky, all the houses in the street are a bit damaged or they get a bit of a shake, but you're the one that actually gets a direct hit. And it's completely devastated. Your life is just completely just ripped apart, and you have to build it, from the foundations all over again. And other people who are in her family or her social circle all have lives to go back to, but I didn't. It wasn't, especially as I'd moved into a new country, that made it even more of a challenge. But I think that's generally a thing that, when your partner dies, that just your whole life is just, just shattered into 1,000 pieces, and you have to somehow not even put it back together again. You have to build something new out of the rubble.
Well, I mean, massive for you in the sense that suddenly you were in a country that was unfamiliar, even though you'd been to Holland. But when this sort of stuff happens, as you say, suddenly you're dealing with a funeral director, and you're going, crikey! I remember what that is in Norfolk.
Yeah.
Or whatever. What happened with the boys? Were you completely straight with them from the get-go, from the beginning of what had happened, and did you talk about it, or was it?
Yes, no, very much. I mean, this is something also that Martha was very keen on. She was very Dutch about the whole thing, very no-nonsense, matter-of-fact. We told them from the beginning that she was ill. Obviously, I think we waited until she got the diagnosis, but she noticed, actually, even before she told them, that they'd noticed something was wrong. She said that, I think I described this in the book, that Adam clung really tightly to her when she was dropping off for school on the day that she went for the appointment where she was told about the cancer the first time. So he perceived that something was wrong, and I think that partly was the cue for her to think, no, I can't just pretend everything's carrying on hunky-dory. You can't protect children from this.
Yes.
She was very firm in saying that, we had to carry them on the journey with us, and they had a right to know, and actually they needed to know. And I totally agreed with her, I think. And I think the fact that we didn't tell them any sweet lies. I guess if you have children who are much younger, little toddlers, you might take a different approach. But they were, well, when they were first diagnosed, they were 6 and 9. So they were old enough to understand, certainly, even though human with autism has quite a few challenges, they were old enough to understand the idea that there was going to come a time, possibly, that their mother was no longer going to be there, and to prepare them for it was a much better way than what I've heard from some people in the situation, where the children don't find out literally until their parents died. And then the grieving process starts for them, with a huge, big avalanche of unfamiliar experiences and emotions. So we prepared them from right through the process. We told them that she was sick. Obviously, when she went through chemotherapy and the cancer treatment,
they could see that.
And her hair fell out, they could see that. In fact, that sort of, I think, in a gruesome kind of way, helped them to understand it.
Yes.
The fact that she didn't have any hair anymore, that she had to spend a day in bed after her treatment, they understood that. And actually, that meant that they, that was something they could relate to, and they could they could understand why their mum was feeling tired or feeling poorly, or just wasn't able to come down for breakfast in the morning.
I think it's as you say, we've learnt this in other episodes. Actually, we had somebody on who talked about how her father had committed suicide when she was 10 years old, and it was never told. You know, it was always sort of, oh, Dad, you know, a bit of a heart attack, you know, don't worry
about it. Yeah.
And the fact that she was never told the truth really made a big difference. And then she was completely told the truth in a ridiculously unpleasant way by somebody else, you know, 5-6 years later, you know. Oh, didn't you know? he topped himself, you know, and it was that awful. So I think probably the thing that comes out of these things is it's very important to be honest. You know, extraordinary stuff. I mean, what was the gap? I mean, I know that you, in my little research, I know that you wrote quite a serious short story or a short version of this book.
Yes.
Did you start writing straight away? And because, you know, you were on your own, literally isolated. And I just wonder whether a journal or writing was your way of staying sane.
Yeah, I think it was. I think certainly I was writing a journal when Mucked Up was first diagnosed. I wrote a diary, and that was really my way of, as you say, staying sane and staying grounded. There came a point, I think, towards the end of our chemotherapy when I stopped. It just got to be too much work. I think trying to combine that with the physical demands of looking after her was too much. But I had those notes, and then obviously she was terminally diagnosed about a year later, so there wasn't a big gap in between. When I came to write the book, I had to fill in a bit of a blanks. But the actual writing started, and I think she died in May 2014, and I think the next January I decided to write the short version because I saw a competition online for writing short memoirs, and it was over 8,000 words, and I thought, well, I'd had it in the back of my mind to try and write a full memoir, but I wasn't sure if it was going to work. And I thought, well, I'll try this, just writing this short, condensed, praised version, and see if that worked, and see if that, at the end of doing that, whether I actually had enough material to write a full length book. So I did that in the January, and once I got that, once I finished that and submitted it, I started work on the full length memoir. So yeah, I wrote it sort of between like 10 months to 2 years after she died. So it's all still fairly fresh.
Right. Yeah. I think that there must have been many benefits to writing this. And most actually, it must have felt, I think I'm right in saying this, that it was something you did for her.
Yeah, it was a monument to her. I always saw it as that way as well. And that was one of the reasons that I wrote it the way that I did. I mean, the structure of it is not quite a linear narrative because I think I started, when I was first actually just sketching out the structure before even doing the writing properly, I sort of realized if you just wrote it from like start to finish, you actually had quite a run-of-the-mill story, basically about a couple meeting on holiday, and then, you know, and then they moved in together, and then they got married, and then they had children, and then the children were diagnosed with autism. But the actual story wasn't going to start until, three quarters of the way through the book, by which time everyone stopped reading. Is not actually very interesting. So I had to kind of piece it together. But I realized the core of the story was basically the period between her diagnosis and when she died. But yeah. I didn't just want to have her, you know, go down, you know, in the records as this sick cancer patient. I thought she deserves better than that. There was much more to her as a person. Yes. So then I had to sort of find a way to fill in the backstory of how we met and how we got together and what her life was like and what sort of a person she was and how well she related to other people. I had to do her justice, do her life justice, because as I say in the book, you know, I'm not a religious person at all. So I think once you die, what's left is the memories other people have of you. So I wanted to put the memories into a form of a book that actually was an honest account of who she was as a person, as well as her experience of going through cancer and this awful, you know, devastating experience that it was for both of us.
Yeah, and you certainly get that from the book. I mean, you get a very strong sense of her. And it's funny, actually, because strong is definitely a word I would associate with her. And yet, you know, she's so feminine, you know, when you see the photograph, this lovely looking person, you know, who does not, she doesn't look strong, but you know what I mean? I mean, she's...
Yeah.
I know that you're living in The Hague. What is the difference, if you can sum it up, between living in Norwich and The Hague?
Well, they're about, I think, 100, just over 100 miles apart as a crow flies. But I guess the difference is that, I don't know, that Norwich owes a lot to the Dutch and the Flemings. A lot of its history was with in the 13th century with trading with the Low Countries and the wool right. trade. So you see a lot of, kind of echoes of Dutch and Flemish architecture when you walk around Norwich. But yeah, The Hague is a newer city. It's a very orderly city of kind of straight lines, tram lines, lots of very identical looking brick buildings. And it's absolutely flat as a pancake. I kind of laugh when people in England describe Norfolk as flat, because Norwich is actually built on a hill. And there's some places where you can, you know, you can get quite out of breath walking around the place. But The Hague is absolutely level flat, except when you get to the coast and we have the sand dunes. But it's a lovely place, and I very much enjoyed living here.
But you were brought up in Norwich. Your father was or is a judge, and you were an only child.
Growing up in Norwich is a very nice place to grow up, certainly as a child. It's very safe. It's a small, compact city. I didn't go to school in Norfolk. I did go to prep school in Norfolk nearby. But then when I was 13, I went to boarding school. I went to Uppingham School, about 100 miles away.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. How did you find that? How was that for you, as they say?
The public school environment, I have to say, it wasn't a happy place for me. I think that was a combination of circumstances. I think I know now that the autism of my boys comes from me, because I've also been diagnosed with autism, and I think that made it challenging trying to fit into what's a very micro society, if you like.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm presuming you're basically alluding to sort of, you know, that it was very difficult to fit him, and that they probably found you likewise difficult.
Yes.
Because you sort of slipped that one in about the autism, you know, diagnosis, because that didn't happen till really quite late in your life. I mean, till in your 40s, wasn't it?
No, it was, after I emigrated. After I lived in Holland, actually, I decided that that I should... I felt as if, basically, I thought some of the things I was struggling with, obviously there was the whole experience I'd had with Martel dying of cancer and raising two boys with autism. But I obviously realised in the course of looking after them and dealing with the care and the support for their autism, I gradually came to realise that this was something that I recognised was reflected a lot back in me as well. Yeah, but it wasn't until my mid-40s until I actually got a diagnosis. No.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But yeah. I mean, we're not going to dwell on that. I'm just interested, from sort of a mental health point of view, that had you had that diagnosis when you were at Uppingham, and had they had that diagnosis, because you're basically going, actually, look, you know, this is a story here, so we adapt and adjust.
Yeah. Yeah, I think definitely. I think nowadays people are a lot more accommodating and understanding. I mean, I think back then it just wasn't really something people considered. I mean, I can think of several other boys at school, well, probably a few girls as well, who, when you think back to those times, that they almost certainly struggled with autism or something similar, or some kind of neurotypical challenge. But it wasn't really a thing that people took into consideration. But now the diagnosis is there, and also, of course, the support that all goes with it, because it's not so much actually having the label, but it's how you respond to it and how people deal with it. There was just no understanding of these conditions of neurodiversity at the time that I was at school. And if there was, I think certainly I would have experienced it differently. I would have understood why I struggled to fit in and found socializing extremely difficult and stressful.
Yes, absolutely. I know that something that your wife said when she was very, very ill, which I thought was very touching, actually, was, you know, she said that, you know, both boys were fantastic to her, and that it was not correct that, with autism, you couldn't show empathy. Which is, of course, the sort of the classic cliche, isn't it?
I mean, yes,
and I thought that was very nice that she said that, and there's a scene in the book you describe so well where one of the boys, I can't remember which one it was, came to see her in either at home or in hospital. And he just, he, you know, basically, he really just wanted to stare through the window. He didn't really want to be there, but he did go and see her and went to the bedside and you know, it was very sort of moving. And that, to me, made sense, you know, what I know about this.
Yeah. I mean, it's a thing. I think there's a difference between, if you like, active and passive empathy, in a way. I think my personal experience from observing my boys is that you feel the empathy, but you find it difficult to express it or to say, or to because you're worried about what's the correct response, what's the socially acceptable way to say how you feel. So you kind of clam up and you don't say anything, and then people assume that you haven't really even noticed how they're feeling. But I notice. I mean, one example, I can't remember if I mentioned this in the book, I'm not sure, but certainly Michael's grandmothers were still alive until actually after she died, which is very strange. But we went to visit one of them once, and she'd lost her husband. She was, you know, well into her 70s. She lived on her own in a big house. And my youngest boy, Adam, came out of the house after we'd seen her and just burst into tears, because he could sense her loneliness, you know, in a way that was overwhelming. And I think that sense of being overwhelmed by emotions, and often, especially several different emotions going off in your head all at the same time and not being able to process them and having them amplified, is a very common autistic experience, I think.
Yeah, well, it's almost a tuning, isn't it? That it's very highly tuned to a deep level, but maybe a lot of the superficial notes don't get played or aren't.
I think a lot of autistic people say they have no filter, and I think that works both ways. Some autistic people are very extrovert and will just blurt out whatever's the first thing that comes into their head without thinking about, you know, how it might come across, and are socially awkward that way. Other people, and I think I fall into this category, and my boys do as well, tend to find the filter gets clogged up because they receive so much, they observe, they perceive so much of what's going around them that they can't cope, they get overwhelmed, and kind of your brain gets flooded.
Yes, yeah, I understand that. Fascinating. Yeah. I think, you know, what we want to do now is I want to try and take you across into talking about the life jackets that we have. And I think it might be appropriate. And I've got your list here, which is really great.
Okay. Yes.
A lot of your choices were very interesting for me. and I thought we could talk about them. And With Nail and I is one of your sort of go-to life jacket movies, and it's an amazing script with Nail and I.
It is remarkable. Every line is a pearl, really. It's an absolute.
I remember buying it, you know, and just thinking, I don't think I'll bother ever to write anything again. It's certainly not a film script.
Yeah.
Bruce Robinson. I mean, it's just whoa. For those who don't know, With Nail and I is set in 1969. In Camden Town in London, and it's about two completely unsuccessful young actors who are hopeless at looking after themselves, except when it comes to alcohol.
That's pretty much it, yes. And then they go off for a holiday in the country, and all goes disastrously wrong. I think my favourite scene, I mean, it'd be hard to pick one, but I think the scene in the cafe has to be. They go into the cafe in the Penrith tea rooms, and they go in and they're absolutely wasted at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I can't remember, Uncle Monty, who's come up and late just and surprised them, takes them out in his very grand car. Uncle Monty's obviously one of these old money people who's never worked a day in his life and lived off his inheritance. So he takes them out and then goes off for an obscure appointment. And meanwhile, they have to kill an hour. So they go into the tea rooms, absolutely off their faces, and start ordering wine. And of course, there's this wonderful juxtaposition between these sort of two, you know, metropolitan losers and the proprietor of the Penrith tea rooms. It's just brilliant.
Yeah. I would say that there's a scene. It's a tiny thing actually. It's a scene where they go into a pub, It's, or maybe it's a cafe. I don't know. It's a pub or a cafe. I can't remember. Yeah. But there's a huge guy sitting outside. And as they walk in, he goes, Ponce. And they're going, oh, my God. And then Richard Griffiths is Uncle Monty. Oh,
no.
What a wonderful performance that was.
That's a stellar performance. Yeah, really is. Yeah.
Blade Runner? What's the story?
Yeah, Blade Runner. I think Blade Runner is one of those films that I saw at a formative time. And Blade Runner, the original film and the new film. But again, it's the script. It's the visuals of it. It's Rutger Hauer, the famous Dutch actor, with an incredible performance. All the actors, perhaps with the exception of Harrison Ford, are remarkable in it. But I think it's actually the visuals of it, the kind of this dystopian landscape you have. I'm always quite tickled because I lived in Glasgow for so many years, and I noticed that Blade Runner, of course, is set in Los Angeles, but it's a Los Angeles where everything's fallen apart. And one of the key things that you know that it's a dystopian future is that it's constantly raining, which obviously to people in Los Angeles must feel like, you know, the most horrible alien hellish experience they can have. But when I lived in Glasgow, that was just how your days were.
How it was. My God, it's sun's out. What's going on?
Exactly,
No, that's brilliant. Brilliant. Okay. Well, it's great soundtrack, I always thought.
That as well. Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Anyway, so moving on now. You know, obviously books are very important for you. And, you know, you've chosen The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle by Murakami. Mm. And, well, he's an extraordinary writer because I just suggest this to you, that most of his books, the characters are quite young.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all like a 19, 20, 21, 22 or something. And I love that. And I love the fact that, I don't know if you agree with this, but you know, you're reading a Murakami book and suddenly the forest appears.
Yes.
You know, there's always, it's like we're going into the forest now.
Yeah, it's a way that you turn a corner. And I think what I love about Murakami, and this is something that really opened my eyes when I first read The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, was that he creates these urban landscapes, but then they're full of myth and wonder and magic. And, you know, the fact that and he picks, I think, the most boring places you can think of, and the most nondescript things in the city. Like, I think IQ81 starts with somebody driving on a motorway in a traffic jam, and then they go down one of those staircases from an overhead bypass, and suddenly they turn this corner into this kind of surrealist realm. And that's what I love about him, he creates these mythical dimensions in the middle of a city, and it's the way the city and the urban landscape is so alienating. And I kind of started going out, especially when Muppet was ill, and my life literally kind of slowed down because we were walking around places rather than going in the car.
Yes.
And actually discovering, looking out for kind of what I call Murakami holes, places in the city. Look out for yourself when you're walking around. A place that you can imagine leads to some kind of weird dimension full of sheep-faced men and, you know, all that kind of thing.
It's a very secret garden.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. Near my son's school in where we lived in Glasgow, you just go up a road, just past a couple of quite modern houses and bungalows, and then it goes over a stream, or over a burn, to use a proper Scottish term. You almost don't notice it, but when you actually look down, you see this kind of sandstone wall, and over the sandstone wall, there's this little metal ladder that leads down into a pipe, and it's all kind of surrounded by this lush greenery, and it's like some miniature jungle. That's a Murakami hole to me. That's the place where you go down that ladder and you discover a world of elves and goblins. You know.
Well, you almost want the pipe to be, you know, a 1'6" in diameter, and that you go through the pipe and then you're into a, you know, an underground interstellar organization. It's great. I think I'm right in saying you run.
Yes.
And therefore, how many times have you read this book?
When I talk about running. Yeah, it's an extraordinary book as well. And one of the things I love about Murakami is the way he writes about pain. Because I think one of the things I love about the Wind-Up Bird Chronicle is that, although as well as being a book about people being stuck in wells, and I'd have to go look at it again, it's also a book about war. you know, and the chap who gets skinned alive, and there's some really gruesome scenes.
Oh, God, yes,
in it.
Yes, that was awful. Yeah.
The fact they can contain all that within one book is just amazing, I think. But, yeah, coming back to what I talk about when I talk about running, he describes the way he does an ultramarathon one time. I think he runs about 50 miles. And the way he describes the pain, the way it takes you out of your body, and, you know, by the time you finish that grueling challenge, you're a different person from the person you were before. I think that's something you can relate to a lot of experiences, not just with running. I've never run that far. I've never run further than a half marathon, but I feel that's something I relate to with grief. I actually think I'm a totally different person now from the person I was when I was living with muscles in Scotland. And part of the process now, one reason I'm glad that I wrote the book is that I've actually kind of, you know, boxed up that person, if you like. I've got a record of who that person was.
Yes.
Because otherwise, I think I've become so detached from him or from them that you know, I wouldn't really relate to them anymore.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting thing to say that. I mean, you know, it's sort of shedding skin in a way, or maybe internalizing skin. But if you weren't the same. If you were the same person, it would be worrying. I mean,
yes.
I mean, you can't go through what you went through and afterwards and not change, I guess. I mean, I hope that's, yeah. Okay, yeah, moving on. We're going to move on. I'm just going to say this because I'm, you know, a fan, but James Joyce.
Yeah, no, I love, I wrote my dissertation partly on Ulysses and another book, Berlin Alexanderplatz by Alfred Döblin. But I also loved The Portrait of the Artist. I think it's just a wonderful memoir as well.
It is.
Yeah. One of the memoirs I think I was probably had in the back of my head when I was writing mine, actually. Yeah.
I first read it when I was 16, you know, on a beach in Worthing. I always say that. It's an extraordinary book. Brilliant. Good. We tick, tick, tick. We like that a lot.
Yeah.
So TV, I'm just going to go to the one that might be interesting, which is you talk about Breaking Bad, which is obviously a very popular.
Yeah, I mean, I loved it as a piece of drama. Muttled and I watched it together and really got into it. And she watched it while she was sick and while she was dying. And she was really absorbed by it. I think she liked the. You know, what you're saying about that she wants to be in control, she wants to be doing something. That's something you see with Walter White. His first thought when he gets cancer is, you know, how do I make sure my family are okay? And, of course, he takes it to the kind of extremes that, you know, ordinary mortals don't by becoming a, you know, major league drug dealer. But nevertheless, you can, on an exaggerated scale, I think that's how a lot of cancer patients cope, that you find a project, or you find a something to do that part one distracts you from the horror of the experience, but also leaves a legacy behind. But also the way.
Well, I'm not going to be beaten. I'm not going to be beaten by this. I'm actually going to outbeat it. I mean, because that was the thing. That was the conceit with that, wasn't it? That, you know, he was a chemistry teacher, wasn't doing very well, disabled son, da, 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 da. And right, I know how to make certain drugs, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the way it all goes wrong as well, I guess that's I sort of felt like the drug dealing in a way was kind of a metaphor for the cancer, because it actually took over his whole personality in the end and made him he led a very blameless life up to the point when he was diagnosed. Then all of a sudden everything went haywire. You can almost say that's, you know, maybe like an allegory for the way that the cells in your body mutate and multiply and rip you to pieces, because that's what happens with cancer, basically.
Yes. Well, it was just interesting also that here was somebody who was very brave. I mean, I didn't care much for the later series. I liked the first two, you know, when he was basically, crikey, you know, I've got to go and have scan, I've got a more chemo, and I'm just trying to do this, you know,
just trying to get by day to day. Yeah, I have to say, I ordered, because I watched it up to the end of the fourth series of Muttled, and we saw the final episode the week before she died, and then I went onto Amazon and ordered series 5 it came in the post the morning after. The morning after we come back from the hospital, and she died, and it is still in the cellophane. I haven't opened right. it. I just can't face it.
I don't blame you. I think that's probably, we're going to keep it there. Our friends in the north. Now, that is very interesting you should say that, because that happens to be one of my fave TV series and also directed by a pal of mine. But, you know, it's, was a great drama series. It's great.
It was tremendous. Yeah, I love the characters and other scenes. Muckle and I, again, it was one that we watched together, and I think we ended up watching the final series in a kind of binge. But yeah, I just love the way that it took you through these people's whole lives, through several, you know, phases and cycles, and the way they, you know, they went their separate ways and they got back together again. And you could still see, in a way, how they were, even though they'd changed and gone off in different directions, that was still the core of it. There was still, you could still recognize the people they'd once been, and all the kind of shattered dreams, and also, you know, there was such a marked difference, obviously, between success and failure. And one became a politician, and the other end of the scale, you had Daniel Craig, who became, you know, a down and out. And then there's that final scene.
Geordie.
Yeah, it's a great bit of acting. I think it's probably, he's much better as Geordie as James Bond. You should have stuck
with
Geordie.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's an extraordinary stretch, isn't it? but they had lots of very good actors, you know, who went on, like Mark Strong.
Brilliant. Yeah, he's brilliant in it.
Gina McKee.
Just loads of great actors and great storylines. Yeah, and just the fact that the actual basic storyline, or where the starting point of it, is a whole story about housing policy. I mean, how you make a great, you know, gripping drama series about the over several seasons about that. You know, you have to be a real heck of a writer to pull that off, I think.
So I would like you to tell me why you like New Order and Templo Diaz, who I don't actually know.
No, that's fine. Nobody's heard of them. They're a band from The Hague, and I discovered them, I think, about 10 years ago. They have almost no following whatsoever, but they've been going for about a decade, just putting out this very, I guess you call it, slowcore Americana with thrashing guitars. But I find them just a wonderful band, and they have a real international mix as well, which I like about them. I think one of them is Dutch, one's French. They have a couple of, they've obviously, because they've been going on so long, members have come and gone. I think they've had some South Americans in. And some of their music is done in several languages at once as well, which I think is great. I mean, when I went to university, I studied the Dadaist movement. It's that kind of idea, you know, the way that language becomes sound almost, or pure sound. It's wonderful. So I thoroughly recommend them. Almost, as I say,
Do they play live?
They do the odd gig. I think they released a new album. They've released a few albums. You can find them on Spotify. They do. Yeah, you know, they've got a decent presence. It's just that they're not that well known, they recorded their first album last year, I think, in about 5 years. And rather poignantly, I discovered, having kind of not really checked them for a year or two, that one of their lead singers had also died of cancer in the last couple of years. That was the reason they'd had a break from performing. But then they decided to reform and put music out, which is good to know. As for New Order, I just liked that whole 80s electronica before the kind of the synth pop generation. New Order, Human League, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. A lot of bands from that era I discovered that later on, The Cure was a band that, The Cure is one of those bands that everyone at my school was at, but because I didn't really enjoy being at school, I kind of didn't really, I sort of avoided them, I pushed them away. And then later on I came back to them and I thought, actually this is good stuff.
Okay. Now, to me, you know, when I've had sort of mental health issues, which I have over the years, you know, the things that have really seen me through it are, you know, friends and obviously certain family, but friendships. Yeah. And, you know, Simon Stewart and Paul Hunter, to give them a name check, are two people who are big for you as Glaswegian friends.
Yeah, people I've known for a long time. Simon is somebody I first met at university, actually, in Edinburgh. And then we both ended up living in Glasgow. And Paul is an old colleague that I first got to know when I was working at the Press Association in Glasgow as a journalist. He's now still living and working there. And both although they live there, and obviously it's been 7 years since I left Glasgow, people I've been very much in touch with throughout this whole time that I've been living in The Hague and been very supportive remotely. And just great. So just those people that you have that you know that, you know, you can go to any time, and sometimes even after a bit of a break, because when you live away from people, yes, sometimes months go by when you're not really in touch. But you know that whenever you get back in touch, that, you know, you just pick straight up as if it's yesterday that you last saw them. There's that real, yes, kind of, I think, connection that you feel. And that's really, important, especially obviously when I first lived here and I had to developed some kind of social life, but didn't really have the opportunity because I was a single father with two fairly young children. So to, yes, be able to keep that connection going with people, which is what things like Facebook are great for, was really important to look out on mental health. And Simon, actually, having been a journalist originally, is now working as a clinical psychologist, so he gives me very valuable insights, often very reassuring when I sort of go through a phase and I'm thinking, am I really coping or are things starting to go off the rails? He's one of those people who can just sort of steer me back and say, no, you're doing absolutely fine, and the fact that you feel like absolute rubbish at the moment is totally normal. So
that's brilliant, and I think it's rare to actually hear somebody compliment Facebook or social media in this way, but of course it is a way of staying in touch with people, and you know that's a really, really important thing. And you know, you're obviously close to MacTel's parents, is that Luke and Deanie?
Yes, yeah, and they've just been absolutely invaluable. I mean, we couldn't have made it I think without them, quite simply. I think, yes, they've always been willing to step in, and even though they don't live nearby, they live out in the country, so it's nice to have a break sometimes from from city life and just have a bit more space, but they're always, you know, they've always unfailingly been there and ready and willing to help out if I've said I need a break, or can you just look after the boys this weekend. They've just always been very, very helpful and supportive.
I think it's great, and it must be great to have something, you know, you need constants in your life, don't you? I mean,
yes,
especially when you've had this degree of loss, I imagine that's important.
Yeah, definitely. And it's sadly, I mean, because I've got to know other widows, again, thanks to social media, actually, it's a common experience that when people lose their partners, they also lose their whole partner's family. They just drift away from their former in-laws or their in-laws, or sometimes they have their big fights, especially if there's disputes over things like property. And I, yes, feel very, very fortunate that none of that has been a factor, and I've had nothing but very positive experiences and support and kindness from Muttle's parents.
That's absolutely as it should be. And and I don't know if you want to have this mentioned or not, but if you don't, we can cut it.
Right.
And that is, you know, that there is somebody else in your life now.
Yes. I've met somebody again through a widow's support group, I suppose you could say. It's a difficult one to quantify, because actually it's another long distance relationship, funnily enough. It took me about 3 or 4 years before I even felt that I was able to think about whether I'd want to be with somebody again. And it's sort of blossomed into a relationship which has had quite a few challenges, especially in the current coronavirus time, when obviously we haven't been able to travel. We survived as a couple and even thrived in some ways. But in other ways, it's been very challenging. So, but it's just been lovely to have that sense of love and connection. I hadn't really appreciated, I think, how much I'd missed that, how much I needed it. I think that was the thing. I think I went through a phase of denial where I thought, I'll just get through the boys' school careers and then maybe think about start dating again. But actually, when she came into my life, I realized how much I'd missed, how much I really missed the presence of another person in my life. And, it's wonderful that we've been able to keep it going. And I just hope that we continue to be a couple through the rest of this pandemic and beyond, because she's a very, very special person. I feel very lucky to have met her.
Well, That's really good to hear. And very often I end our shed talks with the fact that there was a Scottish doctor, who I, of course, rudely called Dr. McTavish, who in 1880 was asked, what do you need to be happy? And he said, you need three things. You need someone to love, something to do, and something to hope for. Would you agree with that then?
I think that pretty much sums it up. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Listen, we've sadly run out of recording tape now.
About
to. And we could do this for another hour without any problem at all. But Gordon, thank you so much for being such a great sport. And I think for people to hear this experience, and certainly to grab hold of the book, absolutely. But more to meet you in this way that we have. Really enjoyed it. And I hope we will meet again.
Great. No, I've enjoyed it thoroughly as well. Special thanks to our mutual friend James Tute, who set the ball rolling. It's been a great experience meeting you in your shed.
Yes, I meant to show you the rest. You really are in it. A lot of people don't think there is a shed. It really is. It's great. Gordon, thanks so much. Tip top and tidy.
Okay, great.
See you later.
All the best, Jimmy. Right.
Cheers out. Then. Bye. Bye. And welcome to Karen Cowan. Hi, Karen.
Hi there. How are you?
Very, very groovy indeed. Very groovy. Good. And great to see you and have you on the show, etc. So here we are. We're back again. And Gordon Darroch. Quite something. What did you think overall?
I suppose what struck me most of all about Gordon was his extreme levels of resilience and how he coped with both moving, which, as you know, is almost one of the first on the Rey's scale of stress.
Yes.
And looking after two children with autism, his own autism, and his wife's terminal cancer. His levels of resilience seemed exceptional. And I kind of wondered whether he was diagnosed late with autism, I believe.
Yes, he was.
And whether he'd spent so long learning to pass, as they call it in ASD circles, that he'd kind of built very high levels of resilience and abilities to cope in these kind of situations. Because it really was quite exceptional what he did and what he got through.
Yeah, no, I mean, I totally agree. And sort of the more we do shed talks, the more amazed I am at some people's stories and what they went through and got through. And with Gordon, of course, it was very strange because he was diagnosed with autism aged 43, 4 years after his wife died. And so he went through that whole period, you know, of being at school, bullied at school, and not knowing any of that information. And I think he said to me, whether it was on the programme or off the programme, he said it would have made such a difference to know that he had that.
Yes, I'm sure it would, and it's sad for him that it took so long to get the diagnosis, because once you have a diagnosis, you know, you can find it easier to find ways to cope. Plus, you can think to yourself, well, I'm okay. I'm just on the ASD autism spectrum, and these are the ways I can cope. Whereas he may have been thinking when he was at Uppingham Public School, you know, there's something seriously wrong with me.
Yes.
Well, that's why everyone's bullying me. When in fact, he was just on the autism spectrum and not neurotypical.
But, you know, I wonder if you could, you know, I'm sure there are lots of people listening to this who sort of go, you know, what is autism? And, you know, because there's lots of misuse of expressions aren't there, where people go, oh, you know, Ted's, he's really on the spectrum, you know. I mean, briefly, what is autism?
Well, I am not an expert on autism. It's a particular speciality. But I can tell you what it's not, and it's not about a lack of empathy, because that's a very popular misconception, because often people on the spectrum do have empathy. And the other thing it's not, which people often think it is sort of obsessive collecting of items or autism savant, where you're brilliant at one thing. It's not necessarily that. I suppose one of the things that marks most people on the autistic spectrum is kind of a need for some kind of order, a need for themselves to be able to put some kind of order into things.
Is that a sort of neurological thing, or is it a behavioural thing, in the sense of often people who had very chaotic childhoods and terrible things happen, that manifests, doesn't it, later in life like that? Or so which one is it?
Well, it could be both. You could be on the spectrum, and you could sort of need a particular order because of how you are on the spectrum neurotypically. And it could be also that you had a chaotic childhood, perhaps because your parents were unable to understand the autistic spectrum. But I think the big thing about the autistic spectrum as well is that it is a huge spectrum, going to very, very severely disabled, back down to really almost not at all disabled, and going back down to your kind of typical kind of nerd who Microsoft and so on desperately want to employ.
Yes.
Because they're so organized and kind of good with numbers.
Yes.
I think in social services, for example, in the NHS, one of the key things is difficulty in social relationships.
Intimacy as well, isn't it?
Yeah, intimate social relationships. And often, for example, children are seen to play alongside their peers rather than with their peers.
Yes, yeah.
So I suppose it's difficulty in social relationships, which would be marked, yes, perhaps by what happened at school. Although, oddly enough, he appears to have sort of just coped so incredibly well. And one of the things I really noted was that he maintained, through all this stress, an excellent relationship with his in-laws. And I wondered if part of that, again, was the fact that he went undiagnosed and he'd learnt so well to cope with his emotions and to override things, that kind of was something that kept the relationship, which turned out to be so helpful, with his in-laws so good.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I mean, I think that the story is extraordinary, and it's very easy to miss. You know, this was the love of his life, the only love of his life. You know, who in the end died at an early age, leaving him to bring up two children under the age of 10 who were both autistic in a country that he didn't know, where there were no loads of pals. And I think it's incredible what he put up with. And I think that sort of the old loneliness point of view, I think was very, very tricky.
Yes, I think so, I think his resilience and strength were incredible. And and about loneliness, I think, you know, as a carer, you are still often missed, because caring for someone with terminal cancer, let alone caring for two boys with autism, is a lonely job. And I feel impressed by him that he talks about kind of joining groups and things, and the power of the group. You know, if you do have a problem, you might be loath to do it, but there's often a group that is in a similar, if not exactly the same, a similar situation to you, and it can be so, so helpful and supportive and break up that loneliness. For example, he mentioned, I'm not sure if it was in the book or here, he mentioned that he joined a group, and I can't remember what its name was, but I know that here in the UK, for
Young
example,
Widowers, I think, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, there's a
it?
Wonderful group called widowed young, WAY, which a lot of people have said has been so helpful.
Yeah,
there are Macmillan groups for supporting people with loved ones with cancer, and there are lots and lots of carers groups, Carers UK. You kind of don't need to be lonely in that way. There's all kinds of loneliness, of course, but
I think I think that's a point well made, and I think though that with Gordon was that his wife died and he had the immediate problem of bringing up the boys in a strange country, as I'm repeating myself, but and what he did was he said, right, I'm going to write a book. And to me, that book is a very, very positive, strong, a beautifully written memoir. Great.
Yes, and I think very much so. And Gordon himself says, you know, the power of writing as therapy is quite extraordinary. And I think writing the book itself will have been a form of therapy. He mentions how he, you know, it really helped him realizing what days things happened, because often you can think to yourself, that can't be true that that happened. And he mentions something about all these things from her.
That his wife could walk 2 miles and then a week later
was in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And sort of, I mean, part of actually PSD treatment is going through the events very, very closely. And in a way, that's what he's done in the book. And it's really helpful to outline how things happened, because sometimes you have misunderstandings that can really wobble you and upset you unnecessarily. So I think that in many ways, writing the book must have been great therapy for him. And it's turned out to be such a great book as well. And almost
absolutely.
A handbook for people who are carers,
yes,
of terminally ill people.
Because it's not just... I mean, it's a book about a romance as well. I mean, from meeting in that campsite to, you know, moving to Holland and dying. And I think the interesting thing about this story is that Machteld, his wife, was Dutch, and they moved to Holland. And the Dutch, in a way, put the Zil into resilience. I mean, they're quite a tough bunch. No frills on anything. Don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, anecdotally and sort of when you see them, that the Dutch people in the Netherlands are very, very well known for their organisation and sort of, it sounds derogatory, but neatness. And I think maybe that's, you know, something that helped them both survive, their sense of organisation and their ability to kind of get things done in an efficient way, both of them.
Cut to the chase,
get things done, get their children sorted. I think that was really, really helpful to them. But to go back to the romance aspect of it, I think, Gordon's told a story of great, great love, of the love of all of them, the love of the boys for their parents, the love of the parents for their boys, and the actual, the power of love in getting through such an incredible experience, and the power of Magda's love for him, because he tried to end the relationship, didn't he? That I don't know whether that's, you know, that came
yes.
in the book, and she kind of stopped him from doing that because she, you know, obviously loved him so much, and perhaps she knew that...
Hang on in there, she said, yeah. Very real. So my parting thing to say to you is that I thought it was very telling, moving, you know, that he said, having gone through all of this and writing the book and a period of grief, and now I am not the same person as I was when I started.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And you didn't have time to really ask him what he meant, but I wondered if perhaps in a way he's gained a lot of confidence from kind of coping in such a really quite incredible way. And of course, huge events, but there is a thing that people never change, but huge events do change you. And it sounds almost like these events have changed Gordon for the better. I wonder if he feels more confident. He must have felt confident to write the book and to get it published. I wonder if it wiped out all those sad memories of Uppingham and whatever happened in his childhood. We didn't talk about his parents at all, but
yeah, so I wonder, you see, if it's if it's also a question that when somebody dies who you love, who you really, really are close to, and you have to go through all sorts of unimaginable things, you know, seeing somebody in terrible pain and having to make your children's breakfast, I mean, much more than that, but you suddenly go through pain thresholds or experience thresholds that you would never normally do.
And there's sort of a question of it doesn't always stay with people, but there is a sort of feeling that I've coped with the worst, everything else is small fry. That doesn't always stay with people, but it sometimes does, and I wish people would hold on to it. But yeah, and also about life. Sometimes when you've seen life end, you can begin to sort of realise how great life is, because you've seen it being taken away.
Yes.
And then you can appreciate again that just life it very self is important, whatever that life is.
Yes. Mm. Yes. I mean, that's it, isn't it? And well, you know, I think we've sort of come to the end of our time on this, but I loved that title of his book. And I mean, we're not into plugging books, but you know, this is a plug.
Oh, yes.
All the Time We Thought We Had.
It's amazing, that title. And I think, as you say, not plugging the book, but it's something worth hanging on to for all our listeners. The Time We Thought We Had.
Yeah.
It's enjoy things now. Even if you're in a ghastly situation,
yeah,
there are the tiniest things that are beautiful, like this summer, for example.
Yeah.
If you can get out into a park or... just hang on to that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. I thought it was so evocative. And anyway, we wish Gordon well in The Hague and on his bicycle. And we hope he's going to learn Romanian fully and Italian fully. God, I'm a multilingualist. So thanks to him. And thanks above all, Karen, to you for being
here. Well, thank you. It's been an absolute privilege, and it's wonderful talking to you and and hearing these remarkable people talk.
Excellent. And our next guest is going to be quite interesting, and we will reveal more later. Okay. Thank
That's
you very
fantastic.
Much.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Thanks, Karen. Really brill. And FAB Control, until the next time.
Okay, great.
Thank you to Stuart Bagshaw, our top engineer editor. Thank you to B. Brooke, our top administrator, production manager. Thank you to Karen Cowan, our top psychologist. If you want to find out more about Shed Talks, visit our website, jeremythomastalks.co.uk. Please sign up to the newsletter. If you want to write to us or find out anything about anybody or contact anyone on the show, inquiries@jeremythomastalks.co.uk. You can find us on Facebook at Shed Talks, Shed Talks Twitter at JT Shed Talks, Instagram @JeremyThomasTalks. So it's all been tip top and totally tidy. Stay safe, be groovy. Please sign up, support, and share this. Thanks a lot. Goodbye.